We try to make business and the economy easy to understand. Sometimes, though, you got to put in the work. Banks, inflation, and unemployment on the program today. Some other stuff as well, of course. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, 14 October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, sometimes there's a lead story on this show that smacks you right in the face, that you don't have to work too hard to figure out. And then sometimes, most of the time, we hope, if we're honest, there are economic lessons to be learned, but you got to work a little bit for it. And today is one of those days. The story is about the big banks. They have been reporting profits this week, pretty good all in all, higher for some of them than a year ago. Another indicator that banks are doing pretty well, even as big parts of this economy are not. Those banks are lowering the amount of cash they set aside to cover loans gone bad. Listen close now to Marketplace's Justin Ho.
It was only in July, 3 months ago, that banks were setting aside extra cash to cover bad loans. But Gerard Cassidy at RBC Capital Markets says since then, banks have watched the economy slowly improve.
That has brought out the banks to recognize that they overcompensated for a more severe downturn.
Big banks aren't all that exposed to businesses that have struggled during the pandemic, such as restaurants, small retailers, and other small businesses, says Nate Tobik, the founder of Complete Bank Data.
They are more exposed to some of the bigger businesses, which have backstops to their credit.
In other words, big businesses can issue bonds. Mid-sized businesses can access the Federal Reserve's Main Street Lending Program. Tobik says the larger banks likely took a look at their clients.
And they think that the majority of these are going to be able to either refinance or pay off their debt from some of these other backstop programs.
Even when loans do go bad, bigger banks have plenty of other ways to make money, says Myra Rodriguez-Valladares, who advises banks on risk.
They have asset management, they have investment banking advisory services, they have trading.
Valladares says banks still face plenty of risks. Many businesses are still in forbearance programs and could owe more once those end. Further federal relief is uncertain, and more people are likely to lose their jobs.
It would not surprise me to see banks in the first and second quarter of next year to again be increasing their loan loss reserves.
JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon said under the bank's worst-case scenario, a double-dip recession, it would need up to $54 billion in reserves, $20 billion more than it has on hand right now. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Here's another story that's going to take a second or two to wrap your brain around. Inflation at the wholesale level, the Producer Price Index, it's called, rose more than expected last month. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer tells us, that is actually good news.
As a consumer myself, I don't exactly celebrate when I hear that prices are rising, but today's higher producer price index is actually a sign that the economy may be picking up. The cost of some raw materials is increasing because of higher demand from factories that are ramping up, says Camelia Kunin. She teaches finance at the University of North Carolina.
And they're producing more because they expect higher consumer demand. To me, this is good news for the broad economy.
Good news because factories cranking up production might need to hire more workers eventually. Chris Rupke is chief economist at the global financial group MUFG.
So in this case, because the recession happened so quickly, all we're looking for is companies being able to hire back the workers that were let go during the recession.
And producer prices only rose 0.4% in September. Although it was the first year-to-year increase since March, it's not clear that the producer price hikes will find their way down to us consumers. Stephen Cicchetti, an economist at Brandeis, looks at what would happen if, say, chicken producers raised their prices.
If the price of the chicken goes up, the price of what I pay my grocery store might go up, but it might not.
Cicchetti says maybe the grocery store substitutes, buying less chicken and more beef or tofu. Your store doesn't want to lose your business, so it may just swallow the higher cost of chicken.
And it's sometimes just the case that you can't pass on the price increase.
Cicchetti says the ideal is stable prices that allow consumers and businesses to plan. Today's producer price index could be a step in that direction. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
One more inflation nugget before we go on. Missed this yesterday when the consumer price index came out. Inflation in things, just as Nancy was saying, that consumers buy. It was up just a touch last month, 0.2%. But here's the kicker. Deep in the data, this item, the biggest jump in prices for used cars since 1969, up almost 7% in September, as people still don't want to use mass transit. On Wall Street today, not up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow being Thursday, we'll get the weekly report on unemployment claims, another data point on how this economy is doing 6 months into this thing. 6 months is a significant milestone, actually, because in most states, 26 weeks, 6 months, give or take, is the limit for people to collect unemployment benefits. Usually. But at the risk of repeating myself, there is nothing usual about this pandemic, and unemployment benefits are no exception. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the phone to explain what is going on here. Hey, Mitchell.
Hey, Kai. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Give me the lay of the land here, jobless benefits-wise. And I want to start you with this. The number of people in this economy currently getting some kind of unemployment assistance from the government is 25 and a half-ish million people. Break it down for me.
Well, so there's regular state unemployment insurance, and that's what you usually get. You're laid off by your employer. It's no fault of your own. You get on those benefits. Now, regular benefits usually run out after 26 weeks. Mm-hmm. But of course, this isn't usually, right? Yeah. We have the pandemic. So Congress added PEUC. Okay, that's the acronym. It stands for Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation. Yeah. And it lets people extend their time on unemployment. It adds 13 more weeks of unemployment checks after the 26 regular weeks runs out. And that will run through the end of December. It is fully paid by the federal government.
Okay, so that's the way it's supposed to work. My question is, what's actually happening out there in the place where people are trying to get by?
Well, some people are getting on the federal 13-week extension. Mm-hmm. So I look at these numbers every week. It's a little wonky in me, I know, but we're up to about 2 million people right now who are getting the extension. That's up from 1.5 million at the end of August. But it doesn't look like nearly as many people are getting on the 13-week extension as are running out of their regular 26 weeks of unemployment. Nationally, in the most recent week, about 1 million people stopped getting regular state unemployment, but only 150,000 got on the federal PEUC extensions.
So I think people should remember, right, this was all thrown together slapdash in the beginning when the bottom was falling out. So that's definitely a factor. And I guess that's part of the confusion we're seeing now is people can't get benefits, they just don't know what's going on because it was all thrown together in such a hurry.
Right. And, you know, we're just running out of the 26 weeks, so this is all kind of new, and the states are scrambling. It seems like some states are doing pretty well. California and Massachusetts, they're making sure people know they're about to run out. It's easy to get on the federal benefit. But there are other states where you may have to reapply. People are waiting weeks, and it does also seem like, at least initially, a lot of people are getting denied getting put on the extension, which doesn't seem to make sense because the requirements, the qualifications are exactly the same as for the state benefits, and it's paid for by the federal government.
Super, super quick, Mitchell, because we have mere seconds left. This is all paid for till the end of the year. After that, then what?
After that, anybody's guess. I mean, it's all federal money under the CARES Act. All of this stuff is going to run out at the end of the year.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman on the current state of unemployment benefits in this economy. Thanks, Mitchell.
You're welcome, Kai.
You can hear Mitchell on the Marketplace Morning Report all the time. He and David Brancaccio and the gang that gets up way too early. All you need to know to start your economic day. Check it out. United Airlines reported earnings after the closing bell today. Much like Delta yesterday, a whole lot of red ink because spending a couple hours in an aluminum tube with a couple of hundred other people, empty middle seat or no, give some people the willies. Yes, air is recirculated, masks and all of that, but in this case, perception is reality. In response, at least partly, tomorrow United is going to become the first U.S. airline to offer pre-flight virus testing, a pilot program on San Francisco to Hawaii flights. American and JetBlue have said they're probably going to offer testing soon as well. United's tests aren't mandatory. It's also not free. Could run up to $250. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, that's not really the point.
For airlines, providing access to tests is about stimulating demand, which is still in the tank.
Without easy access to testing, people likely won't get on planes.
Zach Griff covers the airline industry for the travel website The Points Guy. He says airlines are trying to break down barriers for travelers, and United says that extends beyond when people are on the plane. Josh Earnest is a company spokesperson.
Right now, Hawaii has in place a mandatory 14-day quarantine for people who are traveling to Hawaii. And the only way to bypass that quarantine is to get one of these state-approved tests.
So instead of spending the first 2 weeks in your hotel room, you'll be free to move around the islands. At the airport, United says it will use a 15-minute test, but the airline is just the facilitator. A healthcare provider will be in charge of the actual testing and reporting the results to passengers. Zach Griff at The Points Guy says for the airlines, more flights to Hawaii is one thing, but what they really want to do is lay the groundwork for the return of business travel.
And the reason why is because if this is a successful launch and airlines can get customers to get on planes, they will convince passengers slowly but surely that business travel can restart using similar pre-travel testing programs.
For airlines, business travel is the most lucrative part of their operations. From a public health standpoint, virologist Makeda Robinson at Stanford says more testing is good, but the rapid tests that United will be using aren't always accurate.
This kind of sets up a situation where there may be a false sense of security.
She says some passengers could test negative, but still be carrying the virus. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So it's been kind of a roller coaster.
You got that right. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 165 today, a 0.5%, 28,514. The NASDAQ down 95 points, about 0.8%, 11,768. The S&P 500 gave up 23 points, 0.6%, 34.88 there. After Justin's piece on loan reserves at the big banks, let's re-up some data about household debt, shall we, which the banks are exposed to as credit card issuers. $34 billion in household debt got paid off in the second quarter of this year. Most recent stats we have on that from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That was the first decline, by the way, in 6 years, the biggest drop in seven. So how about shares in some of the big banks? Wells Fargo down 6% today. Bank of America dropped more than 5%. Bonds basically flat, yielded 0.72%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not all, but a lot of the talk about the Federal Reserve in this economy is about interest rates and lending programs and bond buying, really big picture macroeconomic stuff. But there is more pressure on the Fed this year, given the events of this year, to do more for more people. And that's why the presidents of the Federal Reserve Banks of Atlanta, Boston, and Minneapolis held a conference last week to talk about structural racism in this economy and what the Fed ought to be doing about it.
The Federal Reserve, as the economic policy instrument in this country, absolutely has to know, be passionate about, be interested in, not just the wealthiest or the median, but all of the people.
That was Ursula Burns, the former CEO and chair of Xerox, giving the Fed an earful there on her panel. Just like Jeffrey Canada did, we told you about him yesterday. He's the founder of the Harlem Children's Zone.
You know, the Fed does interest rates. Great. They're keeping the economy booming. But guess who that's hurting? That's hurting my mother, who put her money in a savings account thinking that she was going to make enough interest to live on. She cannot. She cannot. Now, what is she going to go invest in stocks? She doesn't know about how to do that. And if we're going to just say, you know what, we've got one tool, it's a hammer, and we're going to hammer everything, can't we think more creatively?
So by the time we got to the panel discussion between me and Neil Kashkari from the Minneapolis Fed, Eric Rosengren from Boston, and Rafael Bostic from Atlanta, things were pretty clear.
We have a role to play.
We have to listen more. And I think this actually is an attempt to be listening more.
This is a time for us to not shy away, but we need to step forward and be present in this conversation and own that we have a role to play.
Which, Atlanta's Rafael Bostic said, is not always how the Fed has thought of its role.
When I first started this job, I had started leaning into this issue that, you know, the Fed needed to care about the full distribution of our population. And if there were people who were not connected to the economy, they weren't producing as much, they weren't contributing, and our economy was smaller than it should have been. When I started, people were a little nervous I was talking about this, but when I was out talking to regular people, they all got that. And they all had in their head that we're supposed to serve everyone.
That full distribution line is important because tens of millions of people are out of work right now, disproportionately people of color. Here's Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari.
There are things the Fed can do to support the economy as a whole, but we cannot put money in pockets of people who've lost their jobs. Only Congress can do that.
Congress is still a ways away from getting more money into people's pockets, as you know, all people's pockets, and that has only increased the pressure on the Fed.
Rafael, I'm going to channel my inner Jeffrey Canada here and say, I don't care that this is what you usually do. Do something better. Get more creative. That was his last answer. Get more creative. What does that look like as you sit at the Atlanta Fed?
Yeah, when I think about what creativity means, I think it's really think about ways that we can touch different parts of the economy in new ways. This series, I think, is a creative thing. Nothing like this has ever happened in the history of the Fed talking about race. We've got to think about how do we lean in to a number of areas that we may not actually have the specific authorities or policies that drive it, but we have information, we have ways of thinking about it that are important. And moreover, I do think that this point that the Fed signaling with its behavior and its actions that we actually believe that we represent all Americans, I think that's incredibly critical. And it will, I have a great deal of confidence because it's happening already, lead us to be brought into a different set of conversations. And that'll also give us new opportunities to influence the trajectory of the economy.
Neil, on that idea of, you know, the Fed being in different conversations, there is a question from the audience that has been asked widely the last number of months and years. What is the Federal Reserve doing in-house, internally, to hire more people of color, more women, train, retain, and promote them? Because that is, as we all know, the product you're going to get depends on the people you have.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think leaders across the Federal Reserve and all the banks and at the Board of Governors believe in that and are committed to it. I can speak in detail about what we're doing in Minneapolis. I'll tell you, when I got here, January 2016, I had a report from some consultants on my desk saying, you have a problem with diversity and inclusion at the Minneapolis Fed. They had surveyed our workers, and women of color felt particularly excluded at the Minneapolis Fed. So I had a meeting with the women of color. It was supposed to be an hour. It went 2 hours, and they let me have it about what the experience was like, and I appreciate them for speaking up. And we've made a whole host of changes and have worked really hard on the recruiting end to make sure that we have a much wider pipeline. And I'm proud to say that, you know, we have about 60 officers in our bank. We've doubled the diversity of our officer corps. That now reflects the diversity of the metro area that we are recruiting from. Every single person that we have hired, I can commit to you, we've hired the very best talent available, but we have worked harder on the front end to cast a wider net. And now, it's funny, word is out. Now we're getting more really top talented people of all races saying, hey, I want to go work there. So you can do it. You can absolutely diversify, but it takes concerted effort from the leadership team.
Eric Rosengren, this may not be a fair question to ask you, but you're here and Chair Powell is not. So I'd like you to speak to this issue at the broader level of the Federal Reserve generally and at headquarters.
So I think across the Reserve Bank system and the Federal Reserve system, we've made a fair amount of progress, but we have a long way to go. So if you look across the Federal Reserve presidents, Rafael is the only African American. So obviously we have room to improve, and I think that's true on our boards. I think that's true in our organizations. But I would say that we've made a lot of progress, and I think it has been a concerted effort throughout the Federal Reserve system. I think Neil hit it on the head. It requires leadership and the desire of leaders to make a change, and I think you're seeing that within the Federal Reserve.
Change, of course, is hard, which is why these three Fed presidents held this event and have a whole series of them planned. In fact, you can watch the one from last week at marketplace.org. So here's a real good word picture, if that's a thing, of the downs and ups of this pandemic labor market. According to the September jobs report, the hospitality industry has added almost 4 million jobs in the last 5 months. But we are still missing, in places where you can go to eat and drink, 2.3 million jobs from where we were in February. Cafes and restaurants are trying to figure out what to do next and how they can keep the doors open. Which gets us to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Keba Conte. I'm the founder and CEO of Red Bay Coffee Company here in Oakland, California. I started Red Bay Coffee to bring beautiful coffee to the people, is what I say. It was a way for me to sort of bring to this industry more flavor, more soul, more equity, more inclusion and diversity that I think was sorely lacking. Before the pandemic, we had over 60 employees. We had, you know, some of the top tier tech companies as our clients and, you know, had six coffee shops. March hit and the coronavirus first started sending people home. First thing happened was our coffee accounts, our office accounts closed down. And then we closed down all our coffee shops, all six of them. A week later, you know, we said, all right, yes, we are an essential business. So we opened up one shop at our roastery, curbside, with my wife and my daughter. You know, there was some pent-up demand, so people certainly showed up. And then, you know, we expanded those hours and brought back more baristas and, you know, eventually opened up a second location. So we were down, you know, to probably like 8 employees or something at the Nader. We're back up to about 35 employees right now. The offices still have not come back. We've got 2 out of, you know, 6 coffee shops back. So it's been kind of a roller coaster, but I would say the sort of a couple of bright spots has been e-commerce. So e-commerce has really become our lifeblood. I mean, it's hard to say we wouldn't be here because I'd always try to find some way, but we might not be here if it wasn't for that. We've had to lay off a lot of people, right? So, and these were people who were, you know, good at their jobs or on a ladder, on a career path to become equipment technicians, roasters, and more. I mean, it's breaking my heart just thinking about it. But, you know, we do see an end to this cycle, and we'll pick back up.
That was Keba Conte bringing beautiful coffee to the people as best he can in Oakland, California. Tell us your story, would you? You can do it at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, which honestly I kind of get. It's a survey from the Marist Center for Sports Communication and the Marist Poll. It says 46% of sports fans say they are spending less time watching live sports than they used to. Here's the money quote from the director of the center. There was an assumption, she said, that once sports returned, sports fans would leap at the opportunity to watch more. But what ratings and the results of this poll are telling us, she goes on, is that fans may have other concerns at the moment, which is true. We do. Also, a brief moment of shameless self-promotion here. Tomorrow on the program, results from the 10th edition, I think it's 10th, it's been a long time, of the Marketplace Edison Research Poll. How all y'all are feeling about all things economic. Spoiler alert, turns out you've got some anxiety. All right, we're out of here, but here is your midweek moment of economic context. Comes to us from the United States Postal Service, saw it in Bloomberg. Data on people moving in the early-ish days of the pandemic. You know those change of address forms you fill out? They come in temporary and permanent varieties. Turns out from February to July this year, temporary moves, that is people changing their lives short-term because of the pandemic, they were up 27% in the same period a year ago. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. Once again, they are going into the studio so the rest of us don't have to unless our home internet is terrible. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.